Welcome to the Bruce Poinsett Show. I am your host, Bruce Poinsett, and this is the world's most dangerous infomercial. Along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this bi-weekly news, interviews, and commentary experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. And you can catch the full show every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM, as well as get clips on youtube.com/BrucePoinsett and exclusive bonus content on patreon.com/BrucePoinsett. Right now, we're live on Twitch, and you can follow the Numbers on twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM. That's Numbers with a Z. But we begin each show with news stories you might have missed but should be on your radar. So without further ado, the news. In fact, before we get into the stories, I want to make a quick correction. On my last segment, I referenced a proposal for a homeless camp with armed guards, and I misattributed that to People for Portland. That was actually came from Sam Adams, aide to Mayor Ted Wheeler. So want to make sure we, you know, get the record straight there. And now, without further ado, the news. So our first story comes from OPB. It's called Research Out of Portland Finds Promise in Pod Villages for Unhoused People. It's by Tiffany Kami, Crystal Ligori, and Sage Van Wing. And in the article they write, a new report from Portland State University found that a majority of people living in these tiny villages are satisfied and that neighbors who live next to these communities grow less concerned over time. They actually conducted an interview with a person from the study, and he notes in here that there are three key factors. One is that there are individual non-congregate units, often called pods, for individual sleeping quarters with a shared common facility that includes kitchens, bathrooms, gathering spaces. Another element is that there are some community agreements and shared behavior and goals. And the third piece is that there's agency among the villagers over the village social and physical fabric. That's what we're really talking about when we talk about villages. And within those six villages, there's a range in terms of a village that's managed by a nonprofit versus those that are fully self-governed. Further, the person from the state says, I think it's clear that we need to go beyond simply the physical components and the architectural look of a village and really think about the social infrastructure and its impacts. So while self-governance might not be possible in all cases, thinking about how to build an agency can be hugely impactful. The Clackamas County Veterans Village, for example, is a managed village, but they have a community council where villages are elected by other villagers and have some say over the aspect of the village. I think the more agency we can offer to villagers, the better is that we're finding. Now, it should also be noted that in this, so I've been referencing Todd Ferry, not just the person from the study, pardon me. But anyways, Todd Ferry also notes that a lot of these villages, while a lot of things have been going well, right now, a lot of them are largely white and largely male. So there's obviously a lot of work to be done on the equity front, making sure all the people who are experiencing homelessness in Portland are, you know, have shelter, have resources. But it is nonetheless interesting to look at these different models that are not just the policy of sweeping people or having the police terrorize them. So our next story comes from the Oregonian, and coronavirus in Oregon, weekly cases climbed 20% by Fedora Zarkin. So he writes, nearly 2,400 Oregonians tested positive for the coronavirus or were diagnosed with COVID-19 over the last week, 20% more than the previous week and 70% more than the week before that, state data shows. The growing case numbers have been expected given the highly contagious BA2 Omicron subvariant and the lifting of masking requirements. Whether or not the increase in cases in its second week after 9 weeks of decline is a harbinger of another surge is yet to be seen, though local experts and officials have said a major surge is unlikely. Multnomah County accounted for more than 1 in 3 infections identified statewide in the past week. The county's daily test positivity rate topped 5% 3 times during that span. Furthermore, Zarkin writes, Oregon is now one of 26 states with rising cases, according to the New York Times. So obviously, just a reminder, we're still in the midst of pandemic. I know I'm guilty of feeling like we're getting too comfortable, or feeling a little bit too comfortable and trying to, you know, get out there and be my best unmasked self. But yeah, subvariants, other variants, it's all still raging. So, you know, be careful out there. I have another story from the Oregonian. It's titled, Intel Launches Training Programs to Oregon Students for Chip Manufacturing. Oh, and it is by Mike Rogway. So Rogway writes, grappling with a global shortage for skilled technology workers, Intel launched two new training programs Monday aimed at directing Oregon students toward careers in semiconductor production. One program is a two-week intensive training session aimed at qualifying community college students to work as technicians. The other is a pilot program to expose Hillsborough High School students to opportunities in technology with the goal of recruiting a broader and more diverse range of potential workers. Intel said it hopes to expand that program statewide. Further in the article, Rogaway writes, Intel is Oregon's largest corporate employer with 22,000 people working at its Washington County campuses. On Monday, the company formally opened a $3 billion expansion of its D1X research factory, which the company has said will ultimately add more than 1,700 jobs. Like many employers, Intel has been struggling to fill open positions. Oregon's unemployment rate is near a historic low, and the state has fewer unemployed people across all than open jobs. Fab technicians are typically the frontline workers operating the tools that make computer chips. Workers typically have a two-year community college degree, and recent grades typically start with wages around $60,000, according to Portland Community College, which is working with Intel on its recruitment efforts. So people wonder, Bruce, why are you talking about Intel? You're just standing for Intel out here. No, but I do think jobs are important, and economic analysis of what's happening is important, because at the end of the day, any of the institutions we see as, you know, powerful or misusing their power, especially their hold over society, ultimately comes to the fact that they can, you know, pay for jobs, they can, you know, pay for people's rent, pay for people to feed themselves, pay for people to take care of their families. And there's a lot of discussions, a lot of times, sometimes we get caught up in the rhetoric. And then you have someone say, yeah, but what are you doing to put food on my plate? So it's always important to keep that in the back of our minds as we're trying to work to, you know, create the society we want to see. And that includes feeding people. So take notes of who is out there, because also, you know, $60,000 a year, just again, it's not a terrible opportunity. But more importantly, take notes of what's happening out there in the jobs world, and also what we can do in our fields and our respective spaces to, again, help feed people, help them take care of their families, on top of changing the culture of the world around us. Next story comes from the Portland Mercury. It's by Isabella Garcia. It's titled, Suspended Portland Teacher Accuses School District of Retaliation. So Garcia writes, Brian Chu, an 8th grade social studies teacher at Harriet Tubman, was placed on leave April 1st while the district investigates his professional behavior. A letter from PPS Human Resources Department indicated that Chu is being investigated because of allegations that he swore and yelled at a school board meeting, told a district staff member that she had failed at her job, coached students to write letters opposing the Harriet Tubman relocation, and told a student to shut up. Chu, a teacher of more than 20 years, argues that the framing of the incidents described in the letter is incorrect and over-exaggerates the severity of his actions. Further in the article, for some more context, Garcia writes, Harriet Tubman School sits about 50 feet from the Interstate 5 freeway. The school was previously shuttered due to air quality concerns, but reopened in 2018 after PPS spent millions installing HVAC air filters inside the school. While the school most likely has the best indoor air quality of any PPS building, a 2018 study by Portland State University concluded that students should not play outside during high traffic hours due to the high levels of pollutants coming from the freeway. Now the Oregon Department of Transportation is planning on expanding the freeway even closer to the school in an attempt to address traffic congestion on I-5. Early design plans indicate that ODOT plans to move the freeway within 25 feet of the school building. Chu has publicly criticized the relocation of Harriet Tubman, arguing that the existing school has the best indoor air quality in the district and that the proposed relocation sites are also nearby high traffic streets. The teacher has also critiqued the district for not involving current Harriet Tubman students in PPS listening sessions and community meetings about the proposed move. So this is important for a variety of reasons. I actually have recently done some activities in Tubman School and had an opportunity to talk with some students about this who were very concerned and participated in a walkout on behalf of Brian Chu. And it is, you get this conflation of a lot of issues, but I think it's important, one, when we talk about the issues of environmental racism, Tubman School is smack in the middle of that. Obviously, you can see with their population is, it's a majority black, brown school, historically black school, and they are, as we mentioned earlier, they had to close before for air quality concerns. They are right by the I-5 freeway, which was creation was a historic, gentrification event in Portland. And right now, relocation is still up in the air. They don't know where it's going to be relocated. But between that, between students, having teachers that, they really feel like they can talk to and engage with, and everything else going on in PPS, this is a story I think we definitely need to keep our eyes on. And finally, we have a story from The Scanner. Portland City Council races draw challenges from community organizers, a union rep by Sandra Sorensen. And unlike the other stories, I'm not going to read any excerpts from this. I'm just going to note that it is midterm season, primary season especially, and the May primaries are coming up. And I want everyone to just get engaged, figure out, who's running for office, figure out what measures are on the ballot that could help create a more just, a more progressive Oregon. Because, people generally tune out during the during the midterms especially, but every election counts, and there's a number of opportunities out there to not just make your voice heard, but really change the levers of power. And that's the news. The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick commercial break. The Bruce Poinsett Show is made possible by the support of members at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. Patreon is a service that allows you to directly support creators like myself through monthly or annual memberships. Become a member for as little as $3 a month and get access to exclusive bonus clips and live discussions. Check out this clip from the page.
Are you defending the prequels? Where does your defense end, Bruce?
So, you know what? Maybe this might surprise you, but yeah, the whole meal deal. I will defend the prequels, kind of. Again, I also had a disclaimer at the beginning that I would not put money on me if I were betting on this as a viewer, but will I defend the prequels? Yes. If you enjoy this content and believe in the community I'm trying to build, please support by becoming a member at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. Welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show. And we've got another edition of everyone's favorite. It's the Mayo Report. So today we're featuring none other than megalomaniac himself, Elon Musk. He's had yet another busy week. And again, we go to the prolific source of white nonsense, that is Vice News, for this story. Elon Musk just launched a hostile takeover of Twitter. So, according to Vice, On Thursday morning, the world's richest man and most notorious shitposter filed an offer letter with the Securities and Exchange Commission offering to buy 100% of Twitter for $54.20 per share in all cash, in an all-cash deal worth $43 billion. Furthermore, the filing contains a letter must sent to the chairman of Twitter's board of directors, Bret Taylor, in which he says, "I now realize the company will neither thrive nor serve this societal imperative in its current form. Twitter needs to be transformed as a private company."
What? What does he mean by "in its current form"?
Yeah, it's a weird thing, because, you know, Elon Musk is really, again, the epitome of what happens on Twitter. And because if he wanted to make the argument, Twitter could be better. There's a lot of, I don't know, it's the Mayo Report. Yeah, white nonsense that just flies while, you know, other people get policed more. You know, again, white supremacist terrorism gets to thrive while they have rules in place for, you know, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
Other, you know, black and brown groups when things are fishy. So it's weird that they can't figure that out, but that doesn't really seem to be much
what Elon is getting to. Yeah, not at all.
No. But, of course, we're talking about, again, the world's richest man and a megalomaniac.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Oh, he has a further quote. This is good, too. "As I indicated this weekend, I believe the company should be private to go through the changes that need to be made," Musk wrote. "After the past several days of thinking this over, I have decided I want to acquire the company and take it private." The message then asks, "Are you available to chat?" Seems...
Wait, repeat that last part one more time?
Yeah, no, it's just, I guess it's in like a chat message or a chat voice transcript, but yeah. Just ask someone, are you available to chat? And this is his best, he also says this is his best and final offer. So, let's see. All the problems with Elon Musk, who already, you know, safe to say with Tesla that he has a pretty sizable market share of power in the world.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's part of this billionaire space race.
Doesn't he own PayPal too? PayPal or Cash App? One of the two.
Not sure off the top of my head.
I will put it on the screen which one it is.
Yeah. Then he also to say, yeah, you've... So, you know, the electric market, you're... got a big share of that. You have this outsized power that, again, you can be in a space race with Jeff Bezos, another billionaire megalomaniac. But no, that's not enough. He wants to completely own Twitter.
Yes.
Everything that's already wrong with Twitter, Elon Musk. Like, if there's not...
Oh, goodness.
You want to think of just like the epitome of the white man. I have a solution for that. I can fix everything. Like this move, I mean,
allow me. Oh goodness. I'm curious now if they're considering taking the offer and what Elon Musk's plans for the future of Twitter would be.
Yeah, so, you know, I guess people are actually somewhat split, or analysts are somewhat split. So they actually have this last paragraph in the article. Right, "Analysts assessing Musk's offer are divided over whether or not shareholders in Twitter will accept the offer. Quote, this puts Twitter's back against the wall. There's really no way that Twitter, in my opinion, could reject this," Dan Ives, an analyst with Wedbush Securities, told CNBC on Thursday morning. However, Vital Knowledge's Adam Crisafulli said in a report that $54.20 price was too low for shareholders or the board to accept, given the company's shares hit $70 less than a year ago. So, you know, from a stock exchange standpoint, that I would love to sit here and be like, I can give you some extra advice. I can't.
No, right.
That is out of my pay grade.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently they're split, I will say, from a public well-being standpoint, from a flow of information standpoint, from a maybe Elon Musk doesn't really need more power.
Just right.
Generally, anyone, I don't know. Like I have admittedly some radical ideas around, you know, how much wealth people should have mm-hmm. before the rest just kind of like goes into actually the public good.
Yes.
I mean, we're in Portland, you know, we're in the midst
of issues.
Yeah. We're in the midst of a massive homelessness crisis.
Yes.
It's hard for me to argue that any billionaire, any millionaire really should mm-hmm. have just even more outsized power. But to be the richest man in the world and say, you know what? While I control the thing that, you know, a lot of people, honestly, because when I go and ask people, you know, in classes or online, where they get the news, Twitter is probably the most common yep. answer I get.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it's just some random social media app. No. This is one of the biggest, you know, mechanisms for the flow of information in the world right today.
Now, most stories break on Twitter first. Like, Twitter is the most, I would say, like, for especially news and information, Twitter is the most useful out of all of the social media apps.
It's not like we don't need to be hypothetical about this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for years, you know, Jeff Bezos, who, again, you know, Amazon guy.
Lex Luthor of our world,
yes. Who acquired the Washington Post, and we've seen how that is, you know, that has influenced the coverage. That is, you see a lot of editorials attacking any raise in taxes mm-hmm. on the ultra wealthy. You see a lot of attacks on labor rights or not lack of coverage on people fighting for labor rights.
Mm-hmm.
So now let's just magnify that to all of Twitter.
Yes.
That a bunch of these news sites, including the Washington Post, have to now, because it's so important, you know, tailor how they post stories and go through to get their stuff out there. Yeah, let's give that to Elon Musk. That seems like a great idea.
This is so dangerous. This is so dangerous. Because, like, Twitter has its issues, as we discussed, but Twitter is one of the only places where, like, a lot of people truly, like, speak their mind and, like, mm-hmm. are able to do as such, whether it be an opinion piece or a piece that's specifically for fact. Like, Twitter has allowed that. But what now when you have someone, and obviously currently I can't say that the owners of Twitter, I don't know a lot about them, but I can't say that the owners of Twitter are not biased, but they're not Elon Musk. And we know Elon Musk.
Again, you know, call me a radical, but just need any more money. Just that's a power. Like, mm-hmm. there's no responsible logic for giving Elon Musk that kind of power.
Too much.
Oh, another juicy tidbit from the article. Earlier this month, Musk announced that he acquired 9.2% of Twitter, making him the company's biggest shareholder. In the aftermath, Musk was offered a board seat in return for not increasing his stake in the company above 14.9%. At least until the company's 2024 annual stockholder meeting, effectively meaning he wouldn't take over the company for at least 2 years. That's encouraging. Musk turned down the board seat, saying in an SEC filing that he would prefer to continue to dunk on the company and its management via the app, also leaving opening the possibility that he could take over the company.
Yo, what? So he just wants to talk crap on Twitter about the board of Twitter.
Yeah. He wants to talk. Yeah. He wants to talk crap about Twitter so that he can take over Twitter just because he feels like it, to vaguely improve it in a way that he has not described. And again, his actions as a person do not suggest mm-hmm. that he is qualified to do. So, yeah, that sounds pretty typical
Our typical, boy Elon.
Yeah, Mayo man. But yeah. in other Elon Musk news, I must
more.
Also from Vice News, your number one source of white nonsense. Did Elon Musk get rejected from the Bergane an investigation? And what is the Bergane, you ask?
I am. What is it?
It is a Berlin sex club. Oh. And that has been the Mayo Report. Yeah. Good night.
No.
The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick ad break. BrucePoinsett.com is your one-stop shop for everything Bruce Poinsett. You have my services such as freelance writing and editing, creative nonfiction courses, as well as customized writing classes, event facilitation, and digital content creation. Again, go to BrucePoinsett.com for a quote and make sure to sign up for my newsletter so you don't miss any news or updates. Welcome back to the Church of Can't Stop, Won't Stop. I'm your host, Bruce Poinsett. And this is the show where we take the book Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip Hop Generation by Jeff Chang, and new edition out right now by Jeff Chang. And my guest today, Mr. Davey D, legendary hip hop journalist, co-author again of the new edition. Davey D, how are you doing this morning, first off?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. Ready to rock and roll, and semester's just starting, so I teach, hip hop down here at SF State, and big shout out to everybody up in the Portland area. We're on every day on KBOO, so our show from down here is broadcast up there, so we're good.
Yeah, it's actually kind of like a cool moment for me, because I've been familiar with your work since probably, I want to say, like junior high. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They post your articles on, obviously, they have like Davey D's Hip Hop Corner, but then, they also post your articles on All Hip Hop and some of these other sites. So,
right. Wow. Okay. And well, we appreciate actually, that.
Yeah. I mean, my editor actually, you talk about KBOO. We used to listen, to like Democracy Now in the mornings, and then sort of like the evening runs at the end of the day include your show. So, like I said, it's a little bit of a full circle moment. But to bring it back to the book, though, I'm curious, when did you first, get connected to, when did you first read Can't Stop, Won't Stop?
Well, I mean, I knew, me and Jeff went to college together, so I know Jeff way before the book came out. I knew Jeff when he was working on the book. So it's all a blur, obviously. I probably read it the first time I got it, because I knew how much he was working on it. So that's, guess early 2000s, was probably when it first dropped. Coincidentally, around that time, I was working on a book, and the book was actually supposed to come out. And so the story behind that was I had my gallery copies, I had my computer, and I had the backup drives. Coincidentally, went into the station on my way back from a library doing the finishing touches, stopped in to say hello, came out, car was stolen. And I lost all that, and never really recovered all that work that I had done. And so when I had the opportunity to join Jeff to do the edition, it was good. I finally got a chance to come around some of the things that were lost, at least in the old notes and, previous iterations we were able to incorporate, into the new one. And here we are, with something I think is really good.
That's it's always a heartbreaking story when you hear, this happened. All my files were here. I had this project gone. So
yeah,
thanks.
Well, somebody just stole the car. They found the car the next day. Apparently, it was stolen with somebody who had a master key to the type of car I had, which was a Saturn. And they found it over there in South Berkeley. And I was begging. that, at least a hard drive would be there, and nothing was there. I did find a gallery copy, one gallery copy that I did have. And so I had a little bit of the iterations, but you know what was ready to come out was gone for good.
Dang. Well, we're gonna get to the new edition, but first, I'm curious, as you know, one, a hip hop historian, but two, especially like based in Oakland, based in the West Coast, your thoughts on, in the original version, sort of the contextualizing of like late 80s, early 90s West Coast hip hop. And particularly, Jeff had this passage or this section, Dub History of Boys in the Hood, where he talks about Jonathan Jackson, George Jackson, the, you know, attempted prison break, and you know, whole story behind that for people watching, including trying to frame Angela Davis. So, you know, for those who are not familiar with the history watching this, I highly encourage you to look that up. But Jeff had this passage here, which I'm just going to read real quick, and I want to get your reaction on it. He writes, Jonathan Jackson's rebellion had been fearless, inarticulate, and fatal. George mourned his brother by writing, I want people to wonder at what forces created him, terrible, vindictive, cold, calm man-child, courage in one hand, machine gun in the other, scourge of the unrighteous. He considered Jonathan a soldier of the people, an image that would find a different resonance in Los Angeles street wars of the 80s. Whether Cube had intended to or not, Boys in the Hood recovered that painful memory. Tracking the lives of Compton Hard Rocks, knowing nothing in life but to be legit, Boys in the Hood became an anthem for the fatherless, brotherless, state-assaulted, heavily armed West Coast urban youth, a generation of Jonathan Jacksons. The impact of Boys had to do with its affirmation, its boast, we're taking over now. Yeah, so kind of curious like how you react to that passage.
Well, I mean, he's looking at a very true story that happened. And if you know the story behind Jonathan and his brother, George, you know, remember George was somebody who went to jail. He was just supposed to be there for a year. And the way the California laws were set up, you know, he was there for, you know, he died in prison at the end of the day. You know, he was there much longer than a year. And, you know, he got politicized. The act of Jonathan just kind of reminds me of Black rage, fed up, willing to fight back. You might not have all the words. You might not have all the perfect, you know, rationale, if you will. You know, are your T's all crossed and I's all dotted? But you know something's wrong. You know something is dreadfully wrong. And you're going to fight back. And I think what he was talking about or capturing was urban rage. Hip hop was born out of that. You heard it. It was born out of urban rage in the Bronx. And when it came to the West Coast, that urban rage was still there. It wasn't just a unique thing to a particular area. All around the country, it was there. And urban rage is a byproduct of systemic inequality. It's a byproduct of ongoing police terrorism. It's a byproduct of being demonized instead of being nurtured. And it's a byproduct of a system that now has an entire ecosystem that benefits greatly off of Black pain, Black death, and Black dysfunctionality. And so the narrative that was constructed in the song Boys in the Hood, you know, which talks about that court scene, that's not the first time there's been an outburst in court. You know, it has happened before. You know, this way you can connect it because we're on the West Coast to what was happening, you know, what happened, you know, probably a good 10, 15 years prior to it coming out with Jonathan, you know, but it represents pushing back on a system that never gave a damn about you in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, kind of to that end, you know, because I think it's one of the things that's just been powerful about the book, and obviously kind of like capturing that story, is just like making those connections, especially for, like, I think about just my generation, you know, being especially like outside of these places, being in somewhere like Portland, where, you know, the context you get, or I should say, you kind of, you get a lot of this like music, but with like the lack of context. It's just what you see in the music video. It's just the history is told by some of the music. So right. connecting it to, especially these revolutionary movements is a powerful thing. But right. yeah.
So, you know, the thing that makes Can't Stop, Won't Stop, both versions attractive is that what we centered around was not so much the artist. We tell stories through the eyes of artists, you know, obviously Crazy Legs, Kuhurk, and others who we spotlight. But Black music / Black expression does not form in a vacuum. What is around it are the social and political dynamics that in many ways inform it, that we react with and react to. And so I think what makes this book stand the proverbial test of time and what allows it to jump from one community to the next, even if you were born post NWA, there are a lot of people reading this that were born in 2000, you know, 2010 who are reading this. Doesn't matter, because the conditions that NWA was dealing with is not much different than the conditions that Kuhurk was dealing with, is not much different than the folks who were part of the Watts Rebellion were dealing with, is not much different than what, you know, our great-grandparents were dealing with in the 30s and 20s and what have you. How we express ourselves in the face of such inequality and such systemic challenges is something that I think people can relate to. In one generation, we were swinging. Another generation, we were bebopping. In another generation, we were soulful. In another generation, we were funkified. The other generation, we were hip hop. And hip hop has evolved in so many different ways. We're bouncing in New Orleans. We're crunking in Atlanta. You know, we were hyphy in the Bay. You know, we were snapping in another part of the country. We were screwing, you know, all these different names that were given to Black expression all come out of the same seed. The expression comes out of the same seed. The dances come out of the same seed, making a way out of no way, making sure that the policies of abandonment in some cities or the politics of containment in other cities, two sides to the same group of people are expendable. Contain them, keep them in Watts. That was the LA thing. These people, these Black people are expendable, abandon them. That's what I grew up in. It's the same situation coming from the same power dynamics that says we don't think you count. And the challenge for us is, how do we take these expressions and use them as a tool for healing and upliftment? And sure, if there's some financial benefit out of it, that'd be great too. But ultimately, people are going to have some form of communicating to each other and to themselves the hardships that they're enduring, the triumphs that they feel, you know, when they overcome some of these hardships. And that's really what the book is about. Hip hop is, you know, it's the entry point to these larger conversations. So, like I said, you weren't around, you know, if I'm looking at you and I'm assuming that you're younger, you know, You definitely weren't around when George Jackson was in jail and killed and, you know, and the Soledad brothers and all that, but you can relate to it. You can read that and be like, damn, okay, now you have the particular details to a story, but this feeling and the spirit behind it, you can relate to. And hip hop has always been able to capture that sort of spirit, which is why I think it's so widespread, which is why it's in all 6 or 7 continents around the world. You know, you can go to Australia and you'll see people reacting to oppression. You can go to France reacting to oppression. You can go to various countries on the continent, in South America. All that is, you know, is how we dance with inequality and systemic conditions that are challenging to us. So that's why I think the book is relatable, because we brought to the forefront those conditions and showed how people were able to battle them.
Yeah. And, you know, the first time I got heard of the book was on this presentation, doing kind of just what you're talking about, making that connection with the politics of abandonment, specifically with, you know, the South Bronx and the South Bronx Expressway cutting through, you know, this community, the, you know, benign neglect policies, landlords having people, you know, literally burn down buildings just to collect the insurance. And basically a presentation connecting that with Portland and the I-5 freeway cutting through the community, the continual displacement with whether it be Memorial Coliseum, Legacy Emmanuel Hospital, I mean, to this day.
So let's just stop there. You have the Interstate 5 cutting through a community.
Right.
Right. We had, what do we start off with? We talk about the Cross Bronx Expressway displacing 60,000 families, right, in the South Bronx where I'm from. Go to San Francisco. What do we have? You know, Gary Boulevard going right through the Fillmore. You know, in Oakland, what do we have? We had the Cypress Freeway cutting through West Oakland, which was the Harlem of the West. Go to Chicago. Every city had the same systemic thing. Black communities having a freeway go right through the heart of them. For what? So white people could leave the city and go to the suburbs in what we call white flight, right? There's documentaries that talk about this. You know, you watch this documentary that the writer James Baldwin did. He goes to Hunters Point in San Francisco. You close your eyes, you swear to God he's talking about your city. Oh, he must be talking about Detroit. Somebody in Chicago goes, no, he's talking about Chicago. You know, somebody in Portland could probably close their eyes and go, no, James Baldwin is interviewing a bunch of brothers from Portland. And it, because it all sounds the same, you know, the brothers and their frustration sounds the same. The challenges that they're facing sound the same. It just has a different street name, you know, but the street, what it bears is the same. And so, yeah, the displacement and the disruption of community is an American thing. You know, it's as American as apple pies, they would say. And through that, blues gets invented. Through that, jazz gets invented. Through that, these other artistic things that eventually get commodified, you know, get quote unquote invented. And they serve a purpose. It helps us, you know, survive those times.
Yeah, yeah. And then the other part with Portland's history is that I-5 and then Memorial Coliseum especially also cut through the historic, basically a jazz central of the city. It's called Jumptown at the time. So there's that other, like a lot of people have no idea around here that, you know, we had this national hub of, you know, jazz talent. Or where jazz talent, I should say, came through. And obviously we had some great musicians of our own, but
right.
Yeah, that history gets, you know, forgotten. But to kind of bring it up to the new book, can you just talk a little bit about why, I asked Jeff this too, but like why, you know, 2021 was kind of the right time for a new edition?
Well, it was actually supposed to be 2020. To celebrate the 15th anniversary of that book. And the feeling was like there's a new generation that could probably appreciate it. Why don't we kind of fill the gaps of things that weren't put in the first book? Let's target young adults and basically update it. But in the middle of doing that, the pandemic hit. And within the pandemic, the George Floyd thing hit. And after George Floyd, the 2020 elections hit. And so all these things were happening, which said, you know, we got to put this on hold and we got to capture these moments because they were so transformative. If we had left those out, the book would seem dated, considering like, man, why do you talk about the pandemic? You know how many people died during the pandemic? How did you miss that? No, we were going to capture that. You know, why didn't you talk about the election? Do you know this was the largest election in American history? No, we had to capture that. Why didn't you talk about, you know, the millions of people that came out after George Floyd? Hip hop was always about, you know, lifting up that type of voice. We had to capture it. So we put things on hold to capture those moments. And it came out, you know, spring of 2021. And we're glad we did. You know, I think it just was a good bookend to how the book starts, you know, with the city of death, Necropolis, politics of abandonment. And here we are, you know, 40 some odd years later, or close to 40 or 50 years, close to 50 years later, we're still faced with similar challenges.
And I'm curious, was there a particular addition to this new version that, or a story, I guess, that resonated with you the most?
Well, some of the things that we did was we were very intentional about bringing to the forefront the presence of women. Well, there's a robust chapter of women in the book, but we just didn't want to tokenize it. And so you probably see through all the chapters. Like if you walked in the room and we're telling the story, then, you know, we made sure that the contributions of women were there. Those stories were told from Sha-Rock to Queen Latifah, all the way down to Cardi B, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we felt that was important because the notion is that hip hop's a male dominated endeavor. And from my growing up, women were always present. They just weren't spectators. They were participants and contributors, sometimes directly, as was the case with Kool Herc's sister, Cindy, who actually organized that party for him, to, you know, me being an MC and lifting generous portions of my older female cousins' rhymes when they were doing their nursery rhymes. Engine, number nine, Miss Mary Mac, you know, let me take some of them things and put them in my own repertoire, right? So it was important to make sure that they were present. The other thing that we were intentional about was realizing that going back and telling the Kool Herc story and the Bambaataa story and the Flash story was something that not too many people are going to really be able to do anymore, right? I think Jeff laid a blueprint that would be hard to really come up with something new, you know, because he told it from the lens of politics and social conditions. So there may be some pioneers like, you know, DXT has a book coming out and others, but just knowing them, they're just going to be adding to that political backdrop. There's no way they can just tell the story. The only thing that would make the difference is like they can say, I was actually here, you know, more than maybe somebody else could. But everybody else, if you're living in Portland like you, you're like, well, what was our history? If you're living in Detroit, what was our history? If you're living in Houston, what was our history? Knowing that in order to tell those stories, it doesn't begin when you hear Sugar Hill Gang in 1979. There was a music scene in all those places that Black youth engaged. And so the question is, how did that scene interact with hip hop as it emerged out of New York? So there was a dance scene in all these cities. There was a funk or band scene and music scene that Black people centered themselves around in all these cities. And telling that history, I think, is important. And then chronicling that history all the way up to particular artists and communities' involvement with hip hop as we know it are important. And so we, in telling the story, said, let's give people a little tidbit. We can't tell the whole story of Portland. So we might mention the Lifesavers or Mike Crenshaw or a couple other people. We can't tell the whole history of Seattle. So we'll we'll prop up a Sir Mix-a-Lot and Nasty Mix Records and Nasty Ness. Can't tell the whole story of New Orleans. So we're going to give you bits and pieces, and we expect, you know, somebody like you, you know, Bruce, or somebody in Seattle, which they've already done, or the people in Detroit, which they've already done, to say, hold my coffee, you know, hold my beer. We got it from here. Thank you. We were just setting the table. Here comes the meal. And we expect and anticipate and want to uplift those localized stories, because that's the beauty of Black people and our ingenuity. That's the beauty of our, you know, respective collective histories. And you know, and you all can do the justice that needs to be done. What we did for you, in theory, is like, you don't have to go back to the Kool Herc story no more. We gave you that jump off. You can read the book and go, okay, you already know the Kool Herc story. We give you a nice mention. This is what was going on in New York, blah, blah, blah. We give a chapter to it, and the other 10 chapters is going to focus on Portland's history, music history, and you're going to talk about that connection with the jazz and the central, you know, districts in Seattle and what have you, and what that meant. And people there will be like, that's our legacy. That's important. And when you really look at hip hop in New York, there was a Bronx history. There was a Queens history. There was a Brooklyn history, because they're all in the same cities, but you know, there's 2 million people where I'm from in the Bronx. And it's probably 1 million people in my section alone. And every block had a history. There's a Bronx River housing project history. There's a Bronx Dale history. So Bambada and Zulu Nation, Jazzy J come out of Bronx River. That's a whole expansive history. Bronxdale, which was the division number one for the Black Spades, the largest gang in New York, has its own history with Disco King Mario and Chuck City Crew. That's a whole history. You know, the home of Judge Sotomayor was also the home of Andre Harrell out of Bronxdale, right? It was the home of Paradise Gray, founding member of X-Clan, right? Then we come to where I'm at in Soundview, right? So Peter Guns comes out of there. But before Peter Guns, there was the Jazzy Five MCs comes out of Soundview, right? And we're talking about housing developments that have tens of thousands of people, right? Some of them have their own high schools, right? You go up to Edenwall Housing Projects, and around that area, Grand Mixer DST, Funky Four Plus One More. These all have deep and rich histories. And these are just housing projects. So we feel it's important that everybody give voice to their lived experiences and connect the dots to the politics that, you know, in many ways they had to engage. And so our job, when we talked about it, let's give a little tidbit. Let's acknowledge, you know, because we didn't want people to read the book and go, yo, how come you didn't tell the whole Portland story? We know there's a Portland story. So we shouted it out, or we gave like a brief mention, because no way we can do 30 years of justice to a particular city, you know, that may have different divisions in that city, right? And different generations. So that's up to other people. But it was our way of making sure that there was some acknowledgement. You know, here's the platform, let's jump off. You know, and, you know, of course, adding those final chapters around Black Lives Matter and all that was important too, to acknowledge what was going on up to the little last moment before we went to publishing was important for us.
Well, yeah. David E., thank you again taking the time this morning. And yeah, we're, you know, for people looking to, you know, find more of your work, where can they go?
You can catch me on Mr. David D., MrDavEyD, Mr. David D. at Gmail is always the best, what's the word I'm looking for? The best, that's my handle. So if you wanted me on IG, Mr. Davey D, Facebook, Mr. Davey D, Twitter, Mr. Davey D, Mixcloud, Mr. Davey D, SoundCloud, Mr. Davey D. So that's where I'm at on all those platforms. MrDavEyD. Thank you. Thank you very much, Bruce.
Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your day.
No doubt.
This has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Make sure to catch us every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM, as well as on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. And for exclusive clips, go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett and become a member. In the meantime, hey, black people. Trust me, it won't hurt. See you next week.